everybody. Welcome back to Banterbox, a review podcast run by the team here at Mad Artists. Each week, we will be reviewing a different production, whether it's a movie, TV show, book, etc. And this week, we watched It Comes at Night. My name is Danielle, and today, we are a little slim. We're going to be hearing from John at the end of everything in an audio clip, but today, it's just me and Sam. So say
hey,
hi,
everybody.
Sam. Yeah, it's real hectic right now and just in all of our lives with us creeping up on our first show and, you know, just having a lot going on. But yeah, so this one is continuing kind of our, like, you know, sort of creepy theme of October. I know Sam and I had never seen this.
No, I'd never even heard of it. I had no idea what it was.
I had never heard of it until I was making a list of different optional, you know, creepy movies that we could do for this month. And this one came up. And I'm a big fan of A24, so I was down for it. But yeah, I just watched the trailer and was like, okay, seems like a cool kind of thrillery vibe. Let's do it. But yeah, this one came out in 2017. It was directed and written by Trey Edward Schultz and stars Joel Edgerton as Paul and Kelvin Harrison Jr. as Travis. You can watch this with a Netflix subscription or you can buy or rent it on Prime Video, Vudu, Apple TV, Google Play, or YouTube. And the IMDb summary for this says, as an unnatural threat terrorizes the world, a man has established a tenuous domestic order with his wife and son. Then a desperate young family arrives seeking refuge.
Yeah, so Trey Edward Schultz, our director and writer, this is only his third movie he has ever directed or written. Mm-hmm. He has two other movies. He's actually primarily a production assistant. He's worked on some different films, but like doing smaller, much smaller production jobs. So the only three films he's directed and written are a movie called Krisha, which was based on his aunt, who's an actor. It was like basically a retelling of a family, an event that happened at one of their family reunions. And I believe it starred his family.
Oh.
Because a lot of them are actors.
Nice.
So Krisha, and then he made a movie called Waves, again, which I think had a couple of his family members in it. And then this movie, which is It Comes at Night, which didn't have any of his family members in it, but it did have Elvis's granddaughter in it. So that's okay.
Which one was Elvis's granddaughter?
Kim.
Nice.
Kim is the granddaughter of Elvis and Priscilla Presley. Her mom is Lisa Marie Presley.
Awesome. I didn't know that. That's really cool. Yeah, so any just initial thoughts before we dive in here? Sorry. Sorry in advance. We do have some noise in the background. There's a dryer running, so apologies if you hear that.
Blame Russell. I think all my main thoughts are going to come more towards the end. I have a lot of thoughts about the last, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Things that I didn't really... It was well done. I will say that. The whole movie was well done.
It was very well made.
The cinematography was good. Honestly, the acting was fantastic.
Oh, every actor in this movie did a great job.
Even the kid.
The kid was great.
Was fine. Like, yeah. No, the acting was not an issue with this movie. I will say it automatically gets points taken off because the dog died, and I didn't like that. I have a lot of thoughts about the end of the movie, but we'll get there when we get there.
Okay, sounds good. This was, and John will kind of mention this in his little pop-in at the end, but this was another one of A24's kind of slice of life-ish things where, you know, it's not necessarily a super intense, like, beginning, middle, end kind of story. It does have it, but it is still kind of that slice of life feeling, which for me, I love slice of life stuff. But for John, it's not his favorite thing. So you'll hear all of his opinions later. But so with this movie, you know what's crazy? So last episode was 28 Days Later, and the summary started with the exact same phrase as this, because when I put it, it started with a highly contagious disease, and then I put in this summary, and I was like, oh my god, like, we couldn't have been more on brand for the past 2 weeks. I promise for the last episode of the month, we're gonna do something that has nothing to do with some sort of, like,
pandemic.
No pandemics. We're gonna find something different, either like home invasion or paranormal or whatever. It's just been the ones that have been chosen, because John picked this one. So yeah, a highly contagious disease ravages the planet. Paul, his wife Sarah, and their teenage son Travis are secluded in their home deep in the woods in an undisclosed location, which we both kind of, well, mostly Sam, but I agreed, is that this was probably North Georgia.
Yeah, it really looks like it's set in Appalachia. the shot outside the window specifically is what made me think that. Yeah. It could also be the Northwest, but it wasn't rainy at all, and it looked like a lot of pines, which I know the Northwest has some pines, but I mean, that's a very Appalachia thing.
Yeah, so probably Georgia. But after Sarah's father, Bud, contracts the disease, they kill him and burn his body in a shallow grave. The next night, they capture an intruder breaking into the house. Paul ties him to a tree and places a bag over his head overnight to confirm he is not suffering from the disease. The stranger, Will, explains he did not know the house was occupied and was searching for fresh water for his wife and his young son. Will offers to trade some of their food for water. Sarah suggests bringing the strangers to their home, reasoning the more people, the easier it would be to defend themselves. Paul reluctantly agrees and drives Will to collect his family. Along the way, they are ambushed by two men. Paul kills them while accusing Will of setting him up. Will explains he fought them and assuages Paul's mistrust.
That was a very weird scene for me because it never came back. Nothing ever came out with it. It was just two guys tried to kill them and they killed them and we moved on with life.
Well, here's the thing is, I felt like throughout the whole movie, there were tiny little chips every now and then chipping away at Paul's ability to trust, specifically Will. And this was kind of one of them, was that, you know, I know he was doubtful for sure about the fact that Will was like, oh, I was just looking for water, where there is probably a well on the outside of the house where he could have gotten water. He didn't have to break in.
So I guess the reason why I disagree slightly is because Will was absolutely correct in every facet of the situation.
What do you mean correct?
Of the whole after them getting stopped and shot?
Mm-hmm.
Because Will ducks down with, you know, like Paul. Paul shoots the guy. Will jumps out and gets into a fist fight and is beating the crap out of the other guy who's mm-hmm. attacking them and has him completely restrained. And then Paul shoots him and Will's like, what? Why would you shoot him? We need to get information. And Will's right.
Well, I'm not saying that Will's bad. Yeah. I'm not saying I believe he is.
I'm just saying it was confusing to me because it seemed like such an obvious Will's right moment. And so when the movie's trying to say that, oh, this makes Paul mistrust him more, I'm like, but why?
Well, because, I mean, you know, the first, you know, sign of, okay, I'm going to trust this guy, you know, he's leading me down this road, and then suddenly he almost gets killed. You know, his first thought is the fact that Will, you know, wanted to, you know, I guess keep him alive. That's why Paul is like, did you know him? Like, immediately is questioning him and thinking that. And he does shake it off.
But Will did almost kill the guy.
But he does shake it off. You know, he's like, okay. But I think it's just like the chips get a little more intense as everything goes on. Because those are like, you know, smaller chips on, you know, a much smaller level of trust. And then further in, when the whole brother thing happens, that's like a bit of a bigger chip. And just like, you know, different things with that. But I think that was the point of that scene, was just to show, like, you know, Paul experiencing that mistrust and then sort of being able to push it down because he's like, okay, maybe he's right. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt for now. But Paul returns with Will, his wife Kim, and their son Andrew. After establishing the rules Paul and Sarah used to stay safe, including A, keeping the only entrance locked with a key Paul or Sarah wear around their neck, and B, keeping nighttime excursions to a minimum, the two families establish a sense of normality and grow closer. One day, Travis's dog Stanley begins barking aggressively at an unseen presence and chases it into the woods. Travis follows the dog into the woods before Stanley's barking suddenly ceases. Travis insists to Paul and Will he heard something in the woods. They return home after Paul assures Travis that Stanley knows the woods and will return home after Paul and will find his way home.
This was, I thought, a well-written scene. So the writing is actually the biggest problem I have with this movie. I think the guy's a great director. His writing was a little sketch for me on some stuff, like even like them getting ambushed and then it was like this weird 5-minute action scene that never came up again. But this scene I thought was well written because everybody responded kind of in the most natural way.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Travis is going to go running after Stanley.
Of course.
Of course, Paul is upset with him and wouldn't want him to. And also, Will does the right thing where Will hears something going on and he goes and he's, you know, he's there to help protect Travis. And, mm-hmm. you know, so then they're all in the, you know, it was a well-written scene in the sense of I was like, yeah, that's exactly how that would go down.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate it because it's the dog and it's stupid. And also, why would, is the idea that he bit the rope? I don't understand how he got off.
It looked like he whipped around and bit the rope. That's what it looked like, is that he, like, ripped himself free.
Yeah.
I also could have seen it as Paul was sort of untying him from the rope but grabbing at his collar, and then he whipped around and bit Paul so that he could run.
Yeah.
I could have seen either of those being what happened, because it was kind of like a quick shot.
Yeah.
But I was like, it was either he bit the rope or Paul was the only thing holding him and he bit Paul.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, considering the fact that, I mean, they never go into Paul and Sarah's whole past, but I'm assuming that Paul is a stepdad that's been around for a really long time. Just because Travis does not look like...
Mixed at all.
He doesn't look half white, half black. Because Paul is white and Sarah's black. He doesn't look like that, so I'm assuming maybe he's from a previous marriage. Or maybe he was even adopted. I don't know. That's sort of why I justified why he would actually bite Paul, is that maybe he just knows Paul a little less.
Yeah. I don't know. The whole... It's you know, it was fine. I just don't like movies where dogs die, so that was upsetting. But the summary there kind of glossed over a little bit. The family, I feel like, fits in really well.
Yeah, they do.
Excepting that one really awkward scene. I don't know. I get what you're saying, I guess, about how, there are all these little things that make Paul mistrust Will. But we'll get there. We'll get there. I'll get there when we get there. I have issues with character stuff at the end.
Okay. But yeah, so that night, Will seemingly contradicts a story he told Paul earlier about him and Kim's activities prior to finding the abandoned house, and Paul's response suggests an increasing distrust of Will.
That one I might have missed. What was that?
That was the brother. That was where they sat down to drink, and he was like, yeah, I'm an only child. And he went, I thought you said that you had a brother who died. And Will's like, oh, well, I considered him my brother, but he's technically Kim's. And then at that moment, Paul basically just gets up and goes to bed.
Okay, see, again, though, that seems like a very fair thing. If it's Kim's brother, and he's all like, yeah, he doesn't want to say my brother-in-law, so he says my brother, like...
Well, but that's what I appreciated more about, like, this movie, is that... You can take it as either way. You can look at it and be like, okay, he's just a really good liar. Or you can take it as he's being totally truthful. But Paul has just gotten to this point where he can't trust anyone except his family. So you can take it either way. And I like that it does kind of leave that ambiguous at the end of, like, you know, maybe he was actually lying the whole time and maybe he wasn't. Like, we don't really get that full answer. But that evening, Travis discovers Andrew sleeping on the floor of Bud's old room, suffering from a nightmare. Travis leads him back to his parents' room before hearing a sound from downstairs. Travis finds the front door of the house is slightly open, and he hears noises. He wakes Paul and Will. They investigate, finding a bleeding and gravely sick Stanley on the floor. They kill and burn the dog, just like they did with Bud. After Travis reveals the door was open before he came downstairs, Sarah suggests sleepwalking. Andrew opened the door. Kim argues the possibility as tensions rise. Paul suspects Andrew is infected and decides they should quarantine in their separate rooms for a couple days so they can calm down and ensure no one is sick. That evening, Travis is awakened by a nightmare about his grandfather, where he wakes up thinking essentially that he's sick, which something that is kind of in the fun facts that I'll get to. Because a lot of the fun facts were sort of just, like, insights about the movie, which I thought was kind of cool. But I'll get to that in a bit. But the next morning, Travis overhears Andrew crying constantly. A distraught Kim tells Will they need to leave. Travis informs his parents Andrew might be infected, and as such, he too may be infected. Paul and Sarah don protective masks and gloves and take weapons to confront Kim and Will. After Paul asks to be let in to see if Andrew is sick, Will draws a gun and takes Paul captive. Will insists his family is healthy, repeatedly tells Andrew to keep his eyes shut, and orders Paul to remove the mask. Will demands Paul give him a fair share of food and water so they can leave. Paul and Sarah overwhelm Will and force him and his family outside. Will attacks Paul and tries to beat him to death as Sarah shoots Will in the back. He dies from his wound. Kim flees into the woods with Andrew. Paul fires at them, killing Andrew. Kim hysterically begs Paul to kill her to end her misery, and he does so by shooting her. Later, Travis awakens in bed, visibly sick. His mother comforts him as he dies. Paul and Sarah, now visibly infected, sit at the dinner table in silence. They share a shattered, devastated look, and that's it.
And that's the issue I have with this movie. That's what I don't like about the writing. It is far, far, far more interesting. So Will and Kim, their actions at the end make a fair amount of sense to me, I guess, because, you know, their kid's infected.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that. She's constantly trying to hide Andrew from...
Yeah, you see his face for like a split second, yeah. And you don't see it clearly, but you can see some black.
Yeah.
You can see a little black.
So, like, clearly he's infected, so... Yeah. You know, if they were being rational, then they would be like, look, yeah, like, but obviously they're not. It's their kid. They're going to be emotional about it, and they're going to act the way they did.
Exactly.
Which was fine. So I guess it's not even character decisions that I have as big an issue with as I have with the writing, because the fact that they're all sick makes everything that happens in the last 20 minutes of the movie not matter.
So
it takes all the stakes away because they're all going to die no matter what. And it actually kind of makes Paul... a bit of a good guy, because guess what? He killed all of them, so now they're not going to go and infect anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes away what could have been this huge moral issue, this whole emotional moment, and it turns it into nothing because they were all infected. So yes, that's what needed to happen. And it sucks, and you know, you hate it, and it felt bad and all, but that's what you had to do. You had to kill them all.
Well, I would argue, you know, I absolutely hear what you're saying. But I would also argue it kind of brings up the moral issue of accepting when it's over and not, you know, continuing to push forward like Will and Kim did and continuing to infect other people and do all this stuff, which granted, you know, that's what would have ended up happening if they had gotten away.
Yeah.
You know, they would have infected other people.
Or they would have died in the woods somewhere.
Or they would have died in the woods.
That's the issue that I have is them... being infected takes away all of the... It really takes away all the stakes, because at the end of the day, they're all going to die, and it's just a question of where they die and if they infect more people.
Well, I think that final moment is sort of what I was talking about, like, of just them sort of, like, staring at each other across the table, where they're both just, like... it's a question of... It leaves it open, because, honestly, I was kind of expecting them to almost, like... you know, just across the table from each other, have guns, and just, like, the ending shot be of them at each other.
But imagine for me, if you will.
Okay.
Everything goes the exact same way. They don't know if the kid's infected. They don't know if anybody's infected. Stanley's, you know, dead in the room and all, and nobody knows who's infected.
Mm-hmm.
You hear, he overhears them talking about wanting to leave.
Mm-hmm.
They go, they confront them. Will realizes what's happening and realizes that they need to get out of there. All of that goes down the same way. They go out into the woods. Everything kind of goes the same way. You know, Will starts beating the crap out of Paul. And Kim shoots Will. And then somehow in all of that, you know, maybe Sarah or maybe Will before he dies shoots Travis. And then Paul guns them all down. Like, exactly like how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of that, Travis gets shot and dies. And then they go and inspect the bodies and none of them were infected.
So here's my thought.
And then you can have basically the same shot at the end of them sitting across the table where everything is ruined and it's all these interesting twists and issues, but it was really all for naught because then the whole idea of Paul's weakness, it even says in the synopsis, it specifically talks about how it's a story about an overprotective father.
Mm-hmm.
Then that is a story about how a father's overprotectiveness and his want to protect his family ended up destroying it. Instead, the argument could be made, Paul was not protective enough.
Here's the thing, and I'm going to take what you said and change one small thing. So, you know, we say that, you know, we saw that tiny snippet of Andrew's face. Even looking back, I'm not 1,000% sure that I did see, like, black. It just was kind of in shadow, like, because he is still kind of behind his mom. So here's my thought. What if they actually never were And what if, because, you know, we know that Travis has insomnia and sleep
issues. So
what if
Travis went into the room and stayed?
What if he sleepwalked? Yeah. He was the one who sleepwalked down there and opened it and walked in and, like, you know, was over Stanley or, like, even touched Stanley in his sleep or something. And then he went back and woke up in his bed. And what if it actually was Travis and Travis was the only one actually infected the entire time?
That'd be interesting, but you'd need to show that somehow.
But that's the thing, is I think the whole point of this movie is that we don't really know what happened. Like, we don't know who was the actual, like, patient zero in the house. Was it Andrew or was it Travis? Like,
but
it could have been either one.
I don't know, because the way it shows it is very much the fact that Kim is constantly hiding Andrew and the fact that Andrew was crying even before, like, he's not feeling well and all this stuff. The movie leads you to believe that Andrew's the one who's sick.
Well, because we're seeing it all from...
If there is no evidence that he's not, then they should show that in some way. And they never did. They never gave a hint to say that, oh, not even, you know, they could have dropped a little subtle thing. Like, you know, they go up there. Like, again, he goes up and looks at the bodies and they don't really look infected.
Mm-hmm.
But then Travis gets sick anyway. And then you don't know. You're like, well, were they infected and they just weren't showing yet? You know, what's going on? And then you don't know. But the fact that they hide Andrew for the last 20 minutes of the movie and he's crying the night before like he doesn't feel well, like he's sick. And then they hide Andrew for the rest of the movie. You never see him really again. And then Travis immediately gets sick. It leads you to believe that they were right. There's no evidence pointing really otherwise beyond conjecture.
Well, the entire thing is conjecture. Like, it's all circumstantial. You know, her hiding him... You know, I think Will just said, you know, Andrew, keep your eyes shut, and Kim hit him because she was like, I don't want my kid to see his dad shoot somebody if he has to. And, like, you know, I don't want him to see
yes,
a dead body.
Yes, but the movie makes a point not to show Andrew.
But that's
what
thing,
I'm saying.
Is the movie is making a point to make you question where it began.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed... If they were trying to make you question it more, he should have... thrown more things in there to make you question it.
Well, I mean, they kind of do when they're sitting at the table. I mean, the fact was they mentioned a very true thing, which is he is a tiny kid and those locks are decently high up and it's like a few locks that he would have had to undo to get into that room. And so, like, that does lead you to doubt a little bit. Would he have even been able to? Like, could he, like, maybe he could reach one lock. Could he reach the one above that? Like, could he actually get the door open and, like, you know, and then walk in and, you know, see everything that's happening? Like, sure, that would cause a nightmare, but could he have actually done it? Which is kind of what is supposed to be so ambiguous is that, like, we don't know if he could have done it. Like, you know, we never saw him reach up to grab a doorknob. Like, we don't know how easy that would be for him. 'Cause he's a little kid.
Yeah.
I didn't have a problem with the ambiguity of it because, again, I think it really is one of those, you know, I know specifically this company really likes doing slice of life stuff, and I think that's what this is.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Same company that did Florida Project?
Same company that did Florida Project. Same company that did Hereditary and Midsommar, mid-90s, all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, I didn't have a problem with it. You know, I like slice of life stuff. But I know it's not yours and John's favorite thing in the world.
Well, it was fine. I had no problem with the concept of the movie. I was really enjoying the movie for the first... Because it was the kind of post-apocalyptic horror movie that I really like.
Mm-hmm.
I love, 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 love post-apocalyptic horror movies and shows that focus far more on, like...
The people than the action.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. On the people, on the... How are you surviving this? What's going on? Mm-hmm. I love that far more than... It's why there's a... So, you know, everybody hates on season 2 of Walking Dead, the farm season.
Yeah.
I was fine with farm season.
Oh,
I love the farm season.
Yeah.
I love stuff like that.
No, I thought that was a great season.
Yeah. But people hate on it because it's slow and, you know, there's barely any zombies until the very end and all that. But I love that kind of thing. I love the survival... human elements of post-apocalyptic versus the action of post-apocalyptic.
What do people do when all their biggest distractions are taken away?
Right.
Like, how do they just
how do they
be
survive?
With each other?
Yeah, stuff like that. So I love that kind of thing. So I was kind of all in on the movie, and then the end just frustrated me because I just felt like they could have made it far more interesting. Specifically that final shot of them sitting at the table. I was like, this could have meant so much more if you had shown that Andrew was not infected. If you had shown that and been able to prove that Andrew's not infected, then it just makes it so much more interesting, everything that just happened.
Well, and that
and then it's a story about the overprotectiveness of a father getting his family hurt instead of a story about, honestly, Paul really didn't do anything wrong. Like, honestly, he didn't.
And maybe that's just a testament to, you know, the lack of experience on Schultz's part.
Yeah.
That maybe, you know, he was, and maybe there was just a different story he was trying to tell.
Yeah.
You know? I think if I were to rename it, I would just straight up call it paranoia.
I'd call it something along the lines of, like, honestly, maybe even something like fatherhood.
Yeah.
Because that's really what it's about. It's about two guys, it's about two fathers and how they, what they're doing to protect their family.
I mean, that's fair. Yeah. So I went on Amazon, was interested because the general consensus by viewers is not really good. Only 44% rated it 5 stars. I actually took 3 reviews, one that's fully negative, one that's fully positive, and one that is sort of frustrated with other, like, reviewers.
Okay.
And when the way they're choosing to do it. So what would you want to hear first?
Let's go positive, negative, frustrated.
Positive, negative, frustrated. Okay. So this is the positive one. It's a 4-star from M. Sullivan, and it's titled Better Than What the Other Reviews Suggest. It says, don't pay attention to the reviews, the trailer, or the title. The trailer is a poor reflection of what this movie is about, and the title is misleading. It's meant metaphorically. I believe most of the poor reviews are from people expecting something else. This movie is a post-apocalyptic slow burn about the lengths people go to keep their loved ones safe. Once I realized I wasn't getting adrenaline-type thrills the trailer promised, I restarted the movie and absorbed it as more of an experience than a wild ride. Every scene overflowed with dread and claustrophobia. The acting is strong, especially the teenage boy who is the eyes and ears of the film. His nightmares are what comes at night, and I found him to be a heartbreaking character. His parents do the best that they can to protect him, but they are out of their depth, as seen in what transpires when a new family arrives. The characters don't always do the right thing, but their decision-making is explained well in the script. There are thankfully few quick edits. You see the beginning, middle, and outcome of every action. When the inevitable occurs, there is a sense of realism that I don't often see in movies today. The final scene may seem abrupt, but it is breathtaking in its silence and finality. This is not a feel-good movie. I wasn't expecting it to be, but I was still surprised how deeply it affected me. 4 stars. And then the negative one is from KT, and it says, nothing comes at night. First off, it says...
I will say the title is not a good title.
No, and there is stuff explained about the title in the fun facts that I'll get to. First off, I'm just going to get this out there so nobody wastes their time. Absolutely nothing comes at night. I'm not sure why it's titled this. It feels like you're watching a long episode of The Walking Dead, except there's no zombies, monsters, or anything supernatural. There really is no ending either. Not sure how this made it into theaters. 1 star. And then this is just sort of the middle guy. But this guy did actually rate it 5 stars, Nathan Beckett. And he titled it, I wish people would actually review how quality the filmmaking was over their personal feelings. This is a very well-directed movie from someone who was able to artfully make the most of a shoestring budget. Who cares if the budget was cheap? People take shots at the wrong things on this site, and unfortunately gave 2 stars to a very well-done movie, resulting in most people having preconceived notions that it won't be good. It is good, and after the last few good movies I saw had such poor reviews from people only wanting to be big Hollywood-style films with action and great special effects over storytelling, after watching this and seeing its 2.5 stars, I no longer value Amazon's rating system or the majority of people who take the time to write reviews to try and sabotage a movie over feeling personally disappointed because it wasn't what they expected or wanted. Doesn't mean the movie isn't good. 5 stars.
Yeah, I will say that. The marketing is terrible. Even the poster on
The poster
Netflix.
Makes it seem like it's going to be like a this paranormal big, haunting thing
It
or
makes
something.
It look like some sort of psychological like paranormal horror movie, and it's not.
It makes it seem more paranormal,
but honestly,
activity.
And I know that you're opposite. I enjoy this kind of movie more than that, so I was I was almost pleasantly surprised.
No, I mean, I like both of those. Like, I'm not partial to an action paranormal movie. I like this.
Yeah, I love post-apocalyptic stuff.
Yeah.
So I was very, when I realized that what that was going on, I was really, really happy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't get any arguments about it not being big budget because I don't think there's any way to tell.
So
honestly, I thought that, like, again, from a directing standpoint, I thought that Schultz did a fantastic job.
Well, here's the thing, and I think people were more, you know, they're calling it low budget because the budget isn't large. You know, when I get to the budget, it's not very big, but it's like it didn't have to be. It's it's like how Hush is considered a low budget movie because they only had four actors and
it didn't need to be there.
And that was it.
I think if he had more money, I don't know that there's anything he would have done differently.
No, I think he would have done the exact same thing, but he didn't need to have a big budget.
Exactly.
Yeah, but apparently, you know, a lot of people were like, the budget was tiny and that's why it sucked. And it's like, no, like, the budget was fine. And while I do agree that, you know, you should at least give, you know, the film its due credit if it is made really well and, you know, well shot and, you know, just, like, it is well done, I do also agree that if you didn't like it for whatever reason, that can affect your review. But I think you should put in there, like, if you're like me and you, you know, want this, this, and this, then this isn't for you. But if you like this, then maybe it'll be good. You know, that's kind of how I like to review things.
Yeah.
Is, you know, I am biased just because everyone has different preferences. So, you know, I didn't so much agree with that part of what he said, but I do agree, you know, give something its due credit if it's made well. I've got John's guesses here, but I'm going to let you go first. Critical score, Rotten Tomatoes out of 100.
I think the critical score is going to be good, but not great. I think critical score is going to be about 71%.
Okay. Well, you definitely win that one because John went real low on the critical score. He went 47 and it was an 87.
Yeah.
And then the audience score out of 100.
I think the audience score will be lower than the critical score, but closer. I'll keep the same thing, 71% for audience score. I think a little lower than critical.
Well, this time John wins because it's a lot lower than the critical score. John put 60%, but it's 44.
I think that is just bad marketing more than anything.
Because
it doesn't deserve that low of an audience score. Because even though I do have issues with it, it is a well-done and really well-acted movie.
And it is intriguing. It keeps you wanting to watch.
I think that's a marketing issue.
Yeah, I agree. I think everyone expected something that they didn't get.
Yep.
And now IMDb, out of 10.
5.3.
Well, John actually beats you on that one because he went 5.5 and it's a 6.2.
Oh.
Yeah. A little better. So the budget was, it gave me a range instead of like a fixed budget, but it was between 2.4 and 5 million and it made 20 million. So it was successful. Okay. It just wasn't a blockbuster.
For a low budget movie like that, I mean,
that's a success.
Yeah, that is a success.
That is a successful movie.
Yeah.
And so there were only a few like fun facts that I was actually interested in. So director Trey Edward Schultz's simplest explanation of the film's title, which he spoke of at a screening in Chicago, is that the title came to him early on in the writing process before characters and plot were fully developed, and it just stuck with him. He has also said it can represent the need to rest, but at night, fear and anxiety can take over.
Yeah, no, he should have retitled
it. I agree, and I think it was a good shooting title. Like, you know, it could have just been, like, what they shot with, you know, how movies will call things different things. But I do think that just for marketing, he should have renamed it.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, when shooting the scene where Paul go ahead.
Even the nightmare stuff, it's in there, but it's not a focus, honestly.
No, like,
it's not a focus of the film.
It's like a C-plot.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
When shooting the scene where Paul interrogates Will in the woods, the boom operator had to sit in a tree for half of the day to record the audio correctly.
What's going on?
Where he still has Will tied to the tree and is interrogating him.
Oh, he had to be
up above, like, just crouched in it. And I was like, dude, that had to be so
low budget.
You can actually see someone behind a tree during the scene where the dog is barking at the woods. So if you looked hard enough, you could
see him.
Yeah, you saw him. I didn't see him. That's why
I
wrote it down.
Because I was confused because I saw him and I was all like, there he is. And then nothing happened. And I was like, but I saw him.
No, they did put someone out there, but they kind of made him well hidden to where, yeah. like, you know, you could see him, but maybe not everyone did, because I didn't, you yeah. know, so I'm sure other people didn't.
Yep.
Travis, in his dreams, never opened the red door when he would walk the house in his dreams. The red door is probably a metaphor for death, but when he was finally shown sick at the end of the movie, he opened the door and went inside, thus symbolizing his ultimate demise.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which I thought was pretty cool. I liked that symbolism. So we can use John, even though he's not here. As far as a recast. Now, obviously, you know, there are people of color in this, and we're just going to cast by, like, characters.
Yeah. I think you would be Sarah, not Kim.
I think so, yeah.
I think John would be Paul, and I think I would be Will.
Okay. I was also going to say I think you could play Travis.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, too, but I think...
John's Paul, for sure.
Yeah, I think the role that I would be best at would be Will. And I think John would also fit really well into Paul, because John has that, like... John's a protective bear.
he's a big bear man. So, favorite and least favorite from this. I know what your least favorite is.
Yeah, my least favorite is the ending.
It was going to be the dog.
Yeah, either one. 1A, 1B, in any order. I think my favorite bit was, again, just going with the in post-apocalyptic, how much I love just seeing life happen and survival. It's going to be a very wide chunk. Everything from when the family showed up at the house to when, presumably, Andrew got sick.
Yeah.
Just the middle section of the movie I really liked, because that's just one of my favorite genres.
Yeah. It's just sort of that, like, you know, just living together in this horrible situation kind of thing. Yeah. Least favorite, I cringe at violence towards, like, a head that isn't quick. So just the moment where he's, like, trying to bash in Paul's head made me cringe a little bit. Yeah. Just because, personally, I don't like watching it. And then favorite... I mean, I agree. I loved that whole chunk. I also just really enjoyed every visualization with, like, the... sort of every, like, dream sequence he had where he would see, like, you know, something that wasn't there and, like, you know, experience it. I like the, you know, the creepiness of that, and I thought it was really cool. So those would probably be my favorites. So I don't think, for your sake, we're going to go with what John used for the out of 10, because I don't think you want to rate it out of 10 diseased dogs.
No.
Because that's what he rated it out of. And I was like, why would you pick that? So let's go with out of 10 buckets, because they mentioned the buckets as, like, a joke.
I would give it somewhere around a
6.5. 6.5, yeah.
Because there's stuff I really liked, stuff I was really frustrated by, and that I thought they could have done better, but overall I enjoyed it.
I will only go a little bit higher, because I did enjoy it.
And again, I will say, and these two are offsetting things, so they're not going to affect it. Dead Dog takes it down.
Mm-hmm.
Great, fantastic acting by the entire cast takes it up.
Yeah.
I mean, the entire cast was...
The cast was phenomenal. Yeah. Like, I really loved all the actors that they had. Yeah, I think I would go with a solid, like, a 7.5. Just because I was really happy with it. I enjoyed it. I love slice of life stuff. And slice of life in, like, a dystopian thing is something I don't see very often. So I liked that a lot. I did take stuff off just because I see your point, you know, with, like, how it could have been more, like, poignant.
Yeah.
And I do wish he would have, like, you know, taken that, you know, like, taken it that step further of, like, especially since Andrew could have been completely fine if he, as a father, realized that he shot the kid and, like, realized the kid was fine. And now he's destroyed his entire family instead. I thought could have been really powerful. So I see your point there. But that's really the only reason that I'm taking it off. I'm just taking off such a large chunk because I see your point. And I think it could have been a lot more powerful than it was. But I liked, you know, pretty much everything else.
Yeah.
And I actually would argue that, you know, along with just what, you know, a pet's death symbolizes, which, you know, anytime, you know, there's a pet death, I always categorize it as a loss of innocence. You know, like, because animals, we were talking about it, are innocent. But in this movie, I actually saw why it was a plot point and why it, like, was the catalyst for what was going to happen next. Whereas in some movies, they just do it for the loss of innocence and not a plot point. So I liked that it was an actual, like, important thing for the plot.
Yeah.
If you have any final thoughts?
I don't think so. If you like post-apocalyptic movies, give it a watch.
Yeah, if you like post-apocalyptic stuff, just know the title is misleading.
Yeah.
It's not about, like, a monster or a ghost or anything like that.
It's not even really a horror movie.
It's more of a thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, if you're going to categorize it, I would say, like, thriller drama.
Yeah, it's much more in the vein of Walking Dead, of the like. It's less horror than 28 Days Later was.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I would agree with that. Like, there are creepy moments, like, you know, with Bud, like, you know, appearing in his dreams, and with, like, you know, things like that. There are, like, creepy horror-esque moments. But again, like you said, I wouldn't call it a horror movie.
Yeah.
So don't look at the title and be like, oh my gosh, they're, like, hiding from something that's gonna attack them in the night. And it's like, no, that's not what it is. Don't expect that.
Yeah.
But yeah, as long as you don't go in with, you know, a bunch of preconceived notions, and you like dystopian post-apocalyptic stuff, you like... I keep saying dystopian is post-apocalyptic. But yeah, if you like post-apocalyptic, you know, people just trying to figure out how to live in this horrible, you know, situation together, and, you know, how fear and anxiety and, you know, puberty and, you know... And, you know, really caring about your loved ones, all that can affect, you know, just how you experience that, and you're interested in looking at those facets, then this is a great movie. Mm-hmm. But don't expect, like, a horror, don't expect a paranormal, don't expect a, like, a monster action movie, because you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so now I will let John pop in with his thoughts.
Hello, hello, it's John, and I thought It Comes Out at Night was an okay film. It serves a great thriller aspect, but overall, it just overarchingly felt predictable. You know, Will's introduced as already being kind of suspicious. We're getting the dreams and the foreshadowing of the sickness taking Travis. It just didn't have a certain draw factor. Now, I did like the overarching motifs of, you know, trust and, you know, it was an interesting handle of the post-apocalyptic genre, post-apocalypse genre. I was pleasantly surprised by the ending with the whole family kind of being sick. We do always love the branching off of the cliche of a happy ending. I don't know why they had to kill the dog. That just made me sad. Like, why you gotta kill the dog, dude? Dog didn't do anything to hurt you, bro. But, you know, I guess it plants that seed of mistrust. But yeah, the movie overall mostly seemed to call on the motifs of, you know, family drama, family ties, family connection. And shows how sometimes, you know, that can lead to hasty decisions. Overall, you know, the movie was okay. Definitely doesn't make my top 10 for, you know, horror or thriller films that you should see in the modern era. It wasn't really super intense. Not even many jump scares either. It just... It came out at night, felt mediocre. It had potential to be good, but it just overall did not read as well as it should have. Or maybe the writing was just poor and they did what they could to work with it. I'm not entirely certain. I'm probably going to give it like... I'm going to give it a solid 4 out of 10 diseased dogs. I don't know what we're doing for the label, for the ratings. Overall, the movie was just okay for me. It didn't have that gravitas and pull that a lot of great thriller or horror films kind of have. Or even shows, really. That gravitas that just kind of pulls you in and keeps you there. I felt myself zoning out a lot. It felt like a weird slice of life horror, which just didn't really register for me. But, you know, overall, it was just okay. Favorite part was probably... honestly the truck fight scene with Paul fending off the two assailants. It was really dope. That was probably the most engaging part of the film for me. Least favorite had to be the whatever he got the disease and the spots were all over him. That was just kind of gross. But I mean, it's a movie about a contagion. So what else did I expect?
And I think that's all we have for today. A bit of a shorter podcast, both just because we have a lot that we have to work on for the show. We can't go as long as we normally do. And, you know, we're missing a person.
Although before we end, yes. I will say, Before we end, this podcast is brought to you by 2x2 Photography. Are you planning a wedding, an anniversary, or other landmark event in the greater Atlanta or North Georgia area? Photographer Robert Lopez at 2x2 Photography is the perfect choice for capturing your special day. His fun and relaxed style will put you and your guests at ease so you can enjoy the occasion and remember how you felt, not how you were posed. When you book with 2x2 Photography, you get a great mix of images, images that tell your story, candid shots, group shots, and general event photos in a mix of black and white and color. Robert is also known for his amazing portrait work, making 2x2 Photography the area's leading choice for graduating senior photos and corporate headshots as well. Mention this ad when you book an event or session with 2x2 Photography and get a free 11x14 gallery print for your wall. It's a $135 value. Learn more at 2x2photography.com. That's T-W-O by T-W-O photography.com.
All right. And just, you know, some news about us. So we are really coming down to the wire on our live show of And Then There Were None.
Come see if you live in the Metro Atlanta, Georgia area. come see And Then There Were None next weekend.
Yeah. It's going to run from
by the time y'all hear this weekend.
Yes. Next weekend.
Running the 22nd to the 24th.
Yes, there you go. 22nd through 24th. Next week, we will be doing, in honor of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, we will be reviewing her Murder on the Orient Express, just to get into that murder mystery spirit. But yeah, so we are going to be performing at, what is the exact name of the location?
It is Emerson Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
There you go.
On Canton Road in Marietta.
There you go. We'll be performing one show on Friday, October 22nd, two shows, a matinee and an evening performance on the 23rd, and then a final matinee on that Sunday. You can check us out if you look in our bio on Instagram, if you look on Facebook, if you follow any of our individual just personal pages, we've all posted about it. You can message us if you can't find the link and want a link to purchase tickets. Please do. It's going to be a fantastic show. We have put so much time into this, and our actors have been working so hard to create an amazing show for you guys. So please, if you just want to have sort of a fun, you know, murder mystery thrillery experience with us, please come out and see it. We will be adhering to COVID regulations as well. You know, if you are, you know, fully vaccinated and want to bring your vaccination card, then you can enjoy the show without a mask. Otherwise, we will be having everybody masked up. We'll be temperature checking, all of that good stuff. We don't want anyone to get sick. We want everyone to have a great time. So yeah, that's going to be running October 22nd through 24th. And we are finishing up Call of Cthulhu. The end has just slowed down a little bit, obviously, because we've been working on our live show. And all of us that are involved in Call of Cthulhu are also involved in our live show. So as soon as that's finished, we'll be putting that out as well. Please follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Mad Artists Entertainment or on Twitter at @artists_mad. You can visit our website for more information, madartistco.com. If you have any questions about the show, questions about our audio drama or anything we're doing in the future, if you have any about the podcast, comments, questions, corrections, or requests for us, you can message our social media or you can email us at banterbox.madartists@gmail.com. Please leave us a review anywhere that you're listening. It helps us out a lot, and we will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.